from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
You have probably never heard of the Military Council of Catholic Women, the MCCW, an international network of Catholic women either serving in or connected to the U.S. Armed Forces. You probably also have not heard of the immense good they do across the globe, wherever the U.S. military is deployed or their families are stationed. This week on Register Radio, we talk with Register contributor Michelle McAloon to learn more. And then, Tessa Gervasini from the Catholic News Agency joins us to tell us about this week's just-concluded meeting of the U.S. bishops in Baltimore. Hello, I'm Matthew Bunsen, host of Register Radio and EWTN News' Vice President and Editorial Director. I'm here in our Washington, D.C. studio, as always and whenever possible, with Shannon Mullen, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register. How are you, Shannon?
Very well, Matthew.
Well, there's a lot happening in Baltimore, but we want to get to a very important story that I don't think a lot of people know about, and that, of course, is the Military Council of Catholic Women. As I said, the MCCW, it's a nonprofit subsidiary organization of the Archdiocese for the Military Services. It's found in 220 military installations and communities across the globe and is recognized and endorsed as the official AMS, or Military Services Archdiocese, Women's Ministry. To tell us about this is Michelle McAloon, who's a military veteran, canon lawyer, and the host of the podcast Crossword Books. And she joins us now. Michelle, great to have you.
Oh, great to be on. Thank you very much.
Well, you've had quite a journey going from flying planes and helicopters to grappling with church law. That also means you are something of an expert in what it means to serve in the U.S. military and to be a Catholic. Let's start with that big picture. How many Catholics are there in the armed forces, and how does the church provide the pastoral and sacramental care they need?
It's interesting. The armed services today it's 25% Catholic. It's the single largest denomination in the U.S. military. Of course, how they do the sacraments is they use priest chaplains that are endorsed by the Archdiocese for Military Services. And each post has a Catholic chaplain or a Catholic priest chaplain. This is an active duty officer that serves as an active duty officer and usually as an advisor to a unit or to command structure and as a priest. So these are very busy men, and they travel. If they try to cover every post, but if they can't, they travel to different units. They travel. They're on the war front. They're everywhere in the world.
Michelle, it wouldn't be a story about the U.S. military without some acronyms. So we have some here. The AMS, the MCCW, and the CWOC.
Okay.
So take us through those very quickly, if you would.
Okay. The AMS is the Archdiocese for Military Services, USA, and that serves, it does exactly that. It serves the military. The MCCW is the Military Council of Catholic Women, and CWOC is the Catholic Women of the Chapel, and those are on installations around the world, kind of under the guise of the MCCW, and what they're called CWOCs for short. They help support the Catholic chaplain in his duties, and it's women, groups of women getting together, both active retired spouses getting together and with evangelization study and really just kind of a support network in this very mobile and chaotic life sometimes.
Yeah, really boots on the ground, really in the true sense of that word. You know, one of the things that is so important for people to understand is the difficulty that military families have. As you mentioned in your story, you know, they're typically moving every 2 to 3 years. That puts enormous stress on families, but it also puts a lot of strain on having a sense of Catholic community. So this seems to be such an important aspect of creating that community in some of these far-flung places.
It absolutely is. It really is. It's kind of a network. And when you go to the retreats, you see people that you've seen in other posts, and the the friendships that are formed like cross lines. And now with the networking is easier, of course, with social media. But it's always great to see people in person and to swap, you know, swap war stories. And it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, Michelle, you mentioned the important role of chaplains. And of course, it is one of the unfortunate realities that there just aren't enough Catholic chaplains to go around, given the far-flung nature of the U.S. military and the number of Catholics who are involved. So it strikes me that an organization or a ministry like the MCCW really does play an important role. Can you talk about how exactly you do cooperate and help the work of chaplains, because they seem irreplaceable?
They are irreplaceable, and they really are. There's so much work. But, you know, a lot of the times what the CWOC will do is what would happen normally, organically, in a normal parish. And you have to remember that Catholic communities, and they're not parishes, and that's because of canon law and how the AMS, the Archdiocese for Military Services, is organized. So you don't have a traditional parish with a parish council. You really don't have a lot of that. So they'll do a lot of, you know, a lot of the charity work, a lot of the fellowship, a lot of, they're the volunteers a lot of times for RCIA or catechism. These are the people that kind of help keep the Catholic chaplain to keep a community together. Because remember that Catholic chaplain, they also have another full-time job, and that's advising units. So,
yeah, Michelle, tell us a little bit about your own experience as a Catholic in the U.S. Army.
I tell you, it's actually been really good. And, you know, one thing, the Department of Defense and Department of War, a couple of years ago, they put out a policy paper on how commanders can talk about faith. So I think that the U.S. military is probably more faith-driven and faith-focused than regular secular society. These small groups of women, I tell you, you know, I'm a canon lawyer, and I go to my CWOC here in Wiesbaden, my Catholic Women of the Chapel, and I learn something every time I go, because of their natural theology, their natural curiosity of asking questions. And usually they ask me questions I can't answer, so that keeps me on my feet. But the military is actually very pro-religion, without it being cloying or without it being, they really have a nice balance.
Yeah, we obviously don't want to get into some of the controversies that have attended recent years of concerns about life, certainly from the Defense Department and other things. But from your standpoint, the work, for example, of the CWOC globally, and it's you write that this is an independent chapel group in association with the MCCW. It has a presence in different installations throughout the world. And one of the things that really struck me was how the women gather weekly, as you write, to pray, study, and receive the sacraments. As most personnel associated with the military are often located far away from their family networks, the CWOC provides a vital function of care, support, and concern for members. How challenging is it, from your experience, to have loved ones who are so far away being deployed and raising families at the same time?
It's a tough challenge. It really is a big challenge. And some of the senior women that are in now, I mean, they've been heroic, absolutely heroic, where, you know, family member, dad usually has, although there are reverses in that, but dad has usually deployed now 6 or 7 times. We're down, you know, those were through the war years, through the Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, there were just multiple deployments. So it's challenging. It really is challenging. And the CWOC really provides a good network for women. And Matthew, one thing I wanted to tell you is that you hear a lot about what happens in the U.S. military. But a lot of that just doesn't, the controversy just doesn't filter down to day-to-day life in the military. It really doesn't. We are Catholic. We go to the sacraments. You know, every time we go to a change of command ceremony, there is some chaplain, he may not be Catholic, it may be Protestant, whoever is there, stands up and prays for, and you know, we enter into prayer. There's no pressure to pray. I have no problem in a Protestant setting crossing myself mm-hmm. at all. So there really is. There's a lot of freedom, actually, in the military and being able to practice our faith.
Well, I appreciate that. I think a lot of our listeners will be very happy to hear that.
Michelle?
Yeah, I mean, yes, sir.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for calling me sir, by the way.
that's right. That's Alabama.
That's not the military. It's Alabama.
No, it's Alabama.
We've only got a couple of minutes, but tell us, if you could, what drew you to canon law?
I always tell people the same story because it's true. Did you ever watch the movie The Terminator?
Yes.
Okay. What is the one question the Terminator asks? What does it mean to be a human being, right? And that question weighed heavy on me for a lot of years. So I started taking some theology. I ended up with a master's degree of theology in University of Leuven, Catholic University of Leuven. And then we were assigned in Paris, and I went to canon law school. And that question, the answer to that question, ends you with a dead thud at the door of the Roman Catholic Church. What does it mean to be a human being? So that is how I got on this road.
And you're a podcaster as well. I looked at the Crossword Books podcast. You've got an episode up right now about a book on the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Another one on...
Right, that was fun. That was real fun.
Angelica Schuyler. Vampire Epidemic. So there's some there's a lot going on there. So looks very interesting.
It does. You know what? It's all nonfiction, but I actually think the human story is, you know, part of our divinity too, of our creativity and our the way we navigate life and try to find answers. And I always, my show is not religious based, it's not, but you know what? I always bring my Catholic sensibilities to the show and to what I'm reading.
Well, our listeners will have to imagine, because I don't think we can afford the rights to end this segment with the Gordon Lightfoot song, but we'll leave that to your imagination, everybody. Well, it is axiomatic, Michelle, that canon lawyers, in my personal experience, have some of the best senses of humor, and you are certainly living up to that truth. So thank you for that,
and
we really appreciate your coming on. We look forward to further reporting from you.
Okay, thank you. I really, really appreciate it. God bless to you guys.
Well, you're listening to Register Radio here on EWTN Radio. Next, we talk with Tessa Gervasini about the USCCB's meetings in Baltimore this last week. Stay tuned to Register Radio.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back. I'm Matthew Bunsen, host of Register Radio. As always, in studio, whenever possible, as we always say, with Shannon Mullen, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register. Well, the USCCB met this week for its annual fall plenary gathering in Baltimore, and EWTN News was there in some force covering the discussions, the elections, and the documents. Among our journalists was Tessa Gervasini, who works for the Catholic News Agency, and she joins us now here in studio. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you guys for having me here. I'm excited to talk about it.
First time you've been on Register Radio, and
yes,
it won't be the last, but lovely to have you here. So this was also, I think, your first time at the USCCB. Would that be correct?
Yes. First time. Whole different experience than I've ever had, honestly.
So from the standpoint of a journalist, A, how did you prepare, and B, what was it like to be there for the first time? Because it is a very different kind of animal.
Yeah, I think for the things I was covering, I felt like there wasn't a ton of preparation I could do. You just kind of had to get there and see what was said, what they did. I kind of tried to have my bearings about who was in the running for presidency and vice presidency, but other than that, I kind of went into it with an open mind. And then, yeah, just as a first-time experience, it moves quicker than I expected, I think. When you think of an election, I mean, you just see the numbers up on the screen and everything's moving fast, and all of a sudden we have a new president and it's done. Great. Okay. But as a journalist, it's an interesting experience to have all these bishops that, you know, I'm sending emails to constantly and trying to get comments from for things all in the same room at once. So as a journalist, it was a great opportunity to speak with them in person and actually get the chance to ask these questions that, you know, usually I'm trying to find a way to bug them to get my answers on.
Yeah. And we kept you busy. You wrote about a presentation on AI, a beatification cause, which maybe we could talk a little bit about. But the big news, well, there were two pieces of big news. The first was the election of new leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And who are the new incoming leadership of the USCCB?
Yeah, so the new president is Archbishop Paul Coakley, and I actually did not know a ton about him before, you know, there was talk that he was a front runner. He's the Archbishop of Oklahoma City, and yeah, I didn't know a ton about him. I knew he had been, he was the secretary, correct, beforehand?
That's correct.
So I knew he had had a leadership role, but I think it ended up being kind of what I was hearing. I thought it would be, you know, a lot of people were saying him and Flores, who Bishop Flores is now the vice president, were going to be top contenders. And yeah, I mean, it was a close race at the end there. So between the two, if I'm right.
Yeah. So the process always is that unless you win a super majority, it goes to a second vote and even a third as needed. But okay. Really, from the beginning, it was striking, wasn't it, Shannon and Tessa, how close it was between mm-hmm. Coakley and Flores.
Yeah, and ended up being 3 rounds, I believe.
That's right.
So, yeah, it was tight.
Yeah, and what do you think the what should we make of this new team together? I mean, Bishop Flores has been really the, among other things, kind of the point person for the synodality process, both here in the United States and in the synod in Rome. He's also a border bishop, right? So which is the other big news that came out of, or the big headlines that came out of this assembly was about immigration. So what should we make of him being in such a prominent role there, do you think?
Well, I think from the standpoint of the conference, all the things that you've just mentioned, he is, I think, kind of a bridge builder between the USCCB and Rome. Now, we always have to qualify that because there have been assumptions or assertions made of sharp divisions between the U.S. bishops, and certainly this is the case in the pontificate of Pope Francis. I think, as any bishop would tell you, those are very seriously overstated. And I think the unanimity or near unanimity of the votes, especially on the migration statement, would indicate. But it is also a new pontificate. And I think to have someone like Bishop Flores, who is such an articulate spokesperson, both for church teaching on migration, but then also on synodality, as you noted, I think those are really valuable assets for him. But I also love the fact that Bishop Flores is so active on social media. We have bishops who tweet, but he's exceptionally good at it. And I personally love his X handle, which is Amigo de Frodo. So friend of Frodo, which means he considers himself not only somebody who loves Tolkien, obviously, but that makes me wonder if this is either an homage to Sam Gamgee or he looks at himself as Sam, in which case he knows how to do hard work.
Very interesting. Yeah. And the other thing that was in the background was the fact that this was a unique U.S. Bishop Conference in the fact that it's the first time that one was being held with an American pope.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Pope Leo also seemed to be present in a sense. Did you feel that, Matthew?
Yeah, very much so. The fact that the bishops sent their message to him. The fact that he is an American. Now, it's interesting that he was a bishop, but was not actually a member of this conference because he served in Peru and then was taken to Rome by Pope Francis. But Pope Leo himself has talked about how he wants the U.S. bishops really to be his voice in America. And I think that's a very key statement on his part. But he's also somebody who has been pushing unity from the very beginning of his pontificate. And I think the bishops presented him with a very unified voice. I'd love to get your take, Tessa, on this migration statement that the bishops approved.
Yeah, it was interesting. I felt like, I mean, migration and immigration, that was, I mean, that was the overwhelming theme of these couple days. And when I was in the press conference that first day, they had announced that they were going to be releasing this statement, but it got brought up there. And of course, you know, we're all scrambling. When is this coming out? What is it going to say? And I felt, you know, reading it and what they were saying in that conference, I felt like everything was very personal and it was very heartfelt from them. It read to me as a statement like that rather than being very by the book. I don't know. It felt very personal. And that's what they said. They said, this is a personal issue for us. And I think that did come across well. It was also interesting how overwhelming the vote yes was to write that statement and get it out. There was, I think, just a few, maybe two or three who voted against it, if I'm right. So it was interesting that they did have such a unified front on that statement. So that it was definitely interesting to see that.
Yeah. Jonathan Liddell from the Register, who was also there covering it, his piece at ncregister.com talks about the statement and the question is, will anyone listen to
right.
it? So on the one hand, they really have two constituencies here. One is the Trump administration, and it was really interesting, Matthew, to hear them really acknowledge the fact that there is no direct dialogue that's going on between the Bishops' Conference and the Trump administration. You know, you think of in past times where there has been more of a dynamic relationship. But the other constituency is U.S. Catholics, who supported Trump by a significant margin and are at least on board it with the general premise of stricter enforcement of the nation's immigration laws. In practice, you know, that's another story. So do you think, Tessa, that the statement helps, you know, will get the attention of ordinary Catholics in the pews or not?
You know, I don't know. I think Jonathan made some great points. Yeah, this is a unified statement. They came out with this, but yeah, will people listen? And, you know, while the statement is a new statement, they've been saying this stuff on immigration for the last while. This isn't a new take for them, and I still don't know if people have really been resonating with it and listening. So, you know, I don't know if this statement is going to reach the greater population. If anything, maybe it will get talks going with – I mean, will it lead to the administration? I also don't know, but I almost think it has a greater chance of that than a lot of just lay Catholics who, because we hear this every day, and so will this be what changes some of their minds? I don't know.
We can appreciate, too, that the document itself, like most of the bishop's statements and even Pope Leo's comments, reiterates what is already very clear Catholic teaching. Certainly Catholic right. social teaching on prudential judgments related to immigration. I was struck especially in the statement by the fact that they go back to what is even in the catechism, where a nation has a right to defend its borders, and then various things that sort of move from there, and then reminding also against violence and demonization of immigrants, but also of law enforcement. So I think the bishops did try to put balance in terms of church teaching into the document. But the question is, as you're making the point, Tessa, is the average Catholic going to see this and think, oh, the bishops are making another statement on immigration? That's not necessarily impacting my daily life until at least the bishops go home and really start pushing this in a way that is much more upfront in front of Catholics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of Catholics are under the misperception that the bishops are for open borders and general amnesty, and there's a lot more nuance. This was a relatively short statement, but some of that nuance is in there. Anyway, Tessa, on the heels of this experience in Baltimore, you're heading out on the road again this coming week.
Yes.
You're going to be covering the National Catholic Youth Conference in Indianapolis, and there's a big event during that. Tell us about that.
Yes. So next week in Indianapolis, the Pope is going to hold a live talk with teenagers. It will be digital, but it will be in real time. And these kids are going to actually get to the chance to ask him questions and speak with him. And I think it's going to be really amazing for teenagers. Right now, there's such a push of teenagers coming to the church and young people being so attracted to the church. And I think the fact that the Holy Father is willing to take, it's going to be close to an hour, that much time to actually speak with these young kids, I think is going to be really, really positive and a really great experience. So I'm very much looking forward to it.
You know, and to have that Q&A with the Pope, even virtually or sort of digitally, it's a big thing. It's going to be life-changing for a lot of the kids. What are you most looking forward to doing when you're there covering this?
I'm really looking forward to speaking to the kids who are going to be able to ask the questions and hear about just how that experience is and the preparation they've done, because they've done a lot of work beforehand as well.
Yeah. Well, you have to promise to come back then to give us a full report as to how everything went in Indianapolis.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, Tessa Gervasini of the Catholic News Agency, thank you. Thank you for reporting in Baltimore and for what you're going to be doing for us shortly. Well, that's it for Register Radio this week. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, please check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks again for joining us here. Until next week, on behalf of Tessa, our producer, Michael McCall, and Shannon Mullen, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register, I'm Matthew Bunsen. Please take care and God bless.